is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top stories: Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says the regional countries can provide security in the region, urging him to prevent foreign interference. Former top diplomat Fumio Kishida is elected as Japan's new prime minister as the world's third largest economy grapples with pandemic-related economic challenges. Also in the headlines, British demonstrators rally in the northwestern city of Manchester to protest against the ruling Conservative Party's annual conference. Those were the top stories. Welcome. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the presence of foreign forces in the region is a source of discord and damage. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has called on regional countries to provide their own security and prevent foreign interference in this regard. The leader made the comments in a ceremony held for graduates of military academies in Tehran. More details in this report.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has warned countries against the consequences of relying on foreign powers to guarantee their security. The leader was addressing a virtual ceremony held for graduates of military academies in the capital, Tehran. Ayatollah Khamenei added that the presence of foreign forces in the region is a source of discord and damage. He said the armed forces of the regional countries can ensure the security of the region and that they should prevent foreign interference in this regard. The leader also spoke about the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan and its chaotic withdrawal from the country. A row between France and the U.S. over a security pact in the Asia-Pacific was also among issues mentioned by Ayatollah Khamenei. Last month, the U.S. and U.K. announced a deal to provide Australia with technology and means to build nuclear-powered submarines. As a result of the trilateral cooperation, a similar Franco-Australian deal worth $40 billion was scrapped. French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian reacted with fury, calling the agreement a stab in the back. President Emmanuel Macron also urged Europeans to come out of what he called their naivety on the world stage and assert their independence from the United States. Iran's leader said such a spat shows that even European countries, which are not opposed to Washington, feel that there's a deficiency in achieving lasting security because of reliance on the U.S. America's allies are already looking on with concern at Washington's approach toward France and Afghanistan. The approach is seen as a warning to U.S. allies in East Asia and West Asia and raises the need for them to have plans to cut dependence on the U.S. and explore ways to ensure their own security.
Iran has started inoculating its teenage population in a bid to reopen in-person school education. Iran's health minister made the announcement in a ceremony in Tehran that saw his grandson receive the COVID jab. Youssef Jalali reports.
This 12-year-old boy, the grandson of Iran's health minister, Behram Einollahi, Mohammad Sadra, received a Sinopharm shot with the presence of the health minister and local media outlets to encourage Iranian families to vaccinate their children with peace of mind.
I urge all families who have children between the ages of 12 and 18 to send their kids for vaccination. This way we can reopen in-person school classes safely in the upcoming months. I brought my grandson today to get the vaccine to prove that vaccines will bear no harm for children.
Iran has so far administered more than 58 doses of COVID vaccines. This means 68% of Iran's population has received at least one shot. This number was less than 10% around 2 months ago, when President Ebrahim Raisi took over power from his predecessor. Iran managed to accelerate the inoculation campaign by speeding up imports of foreign-made jabs, as well as supporting local vaccine developers.
Only in Tehran, more than 10 million people have been fully vaccinated. This is over 70% of the capital's population. The vaccination of lower ages will definitely help us get our kids back to school safely.
Based on the international health guidelines, minus 18 age groups should receive a single dose of COVID vaccine. The Iranian health minister said the country has taken the same approach and will administer one shot to its adolescents. He said once this phase is over, the health ministry will start vaccinating students between 7 and 12 years old.
While Iran lagged behind in the national inoculation program, it has managed to be among the first to inoculate its teenage population. If all goes as planned, children can go back to schools in less than 2 months. Youssef Jalali, Tehran.
Japan's parliament has voted to approve Fumio Kishida as the country's new prime minister. The new leader is expected to announce his cabinet later on today. His election came after former Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga refused to stand for the ruling party leadership after just 1 year in office. Local media reports say Kishida plans to dissolve the parliament next week and call for an election for October the 31st. He faces a raft of challenges, including the pandemic-related problems of the world's third largest economy. Professor Seijiro Takeshita is with the Shizuoka University, and he joins us live from the same city via Skype to talk to us a little bit more about that. Professor, as always, it's good to have you with us on this show.
Thank you.
Your understanding of the recent events in Japan, of course, like I mentioned, you know, Japan has had its fair share of suffering under the current economic situation due to the pandemic. You tell us a little bit about the situation right now, and how do you picture Japan under this new prime minister?
Well, I think it's a good timing for Mr. Kishida in the sense that the ratio of the vaccine takers has lagged behind quite considerably compared to other OECD nations, but now we've basically done a very good catch-up. And we just had, 4 days ago, a liftoff of the emergency measures, which we've been getting for month and month. So obviously, people's mind is definitely lifted, and anxiety is definitely simmering down. So from that point of view, the overall sentiment of the government's attitude towards actions towards the coronavirus is probably turned to a lot more positive feature than before. So from that perspective, and COVID-19 being by far the biggest problem for any cabinet member, it probably is a very good timing for Mr. Kishida to have the re-election.
Okay, and what about in terms of his foreign policy? You know, I'm very interested to hear about, what way is he going to deal with, I'm not saying large challenges, but some of the, smaller challenges that exist in that part of the world, especially regarding North Korea. What comes to mind when we speak about the foreign policies that Japan will have under him?
Well, one of the very interesting things about his new cabinet members is 13 out of 20 are new members. But there are two which he held on, and that's basically a defense minister and foreign minister. Mm. These two persons did not make a change. Obviously, he wants to sustain the current relationship that these people have built and trying to cope with this aggression that we're facing from China, the hegemony of war between the United States and China. And Japan is obviously being swirled in. And you were talking about North Korea. But the biggest person who has the strongest card against North Korea are not other nations like the United States or Japan. It is China, who has over 85% of trade with North Korea. So obviously, you know, if we have to make you know, a strong stance against these aggressors, obviously Japan has to basically clarify its position at a much clearer point.
Sajiro Takeshita, Professor of Management with University of Shizuoka. Thank you. Have a good day. North and South Korea have restored their cross-border communications, with officials exchanging their first phone call since August. The news was announced by Seoul, which described the move as grounds for improving inter-Korean ties. In a statement on Monday, South Korea said it hopes to resume dialogue with the North to establish a rapprochement between the two countries. Earlier in the day, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un had expressed his intention of restoring the cut-off North-South hotlines in a bid to establish lasting peace on the Korean Peninsula. The two Koreas had signaled a surprise thaw in relations late in July by announcing the restoration of cross-border communications severed more than a year earlier. But the detente was short-lived, as the North stopped answering calls just 2 weeks later, taking issue with joint U.S.-South Korean military drills. Author and columnist Einar Tangen says North Korea's initiative to restore cross-border communications with the South is aimed at de-escalating tensions on the Korean Peninsula.
Well, it's always a good symbol. Obviously, it de-escalates this idea of any kind of conflict. Both sides have been firing off missiles. North Korea has added to what it claims its capabilities in terms of having a supersonic missile, in addition to a submarine missile, a cruise missile, and then they've been firing off short-range ballistic missiles. South Korea has also been firing off and showing that it has capabilities as well. But I think it's most important to realize that earlier this year, it seems that Kim, and through his sister, has said that the reunification of the Korean Peninsula is desirable, but not necessarily something that they're going to be pushing for, that you know, exporting North Korean communism to South Korea and worldwide is not becoming a priority. It was. So this opens up some gate. There's a lot of speculation that what Kim is trying to do is drive a wedge between South Korea and the current administration, which really desires to have reunification or at least peaceful detente.
Thousands of demonstrators have gathered in the UK's northwestern city of Manchester to protest against the ruling Conservative Party's annual conference there. Protesters have described party leader Prime Minister Boris Johnson as a liar, have called on the party, held under a heavy police presence, to leave the city at once. Saipur Reza sent us this one.
See a ring of steel and a little army of police, think the British Conservative Party, here in Manchester for their annual conference, with the party leader pitching his Building Back Better mantra yet again. Crashing the party, thousands of protesters from far and wide to tell the Prime Minister he and his clique are not welcome. There's an array of groups and people who have gathered here today to demonstrate against the Conservative government, pretty much everything it stands for, from its domestic policy to foreign policy, from its pandemic response and its position on migrants to its participation in foreign wars and its support for foreign occupation. And they say examples of the government's failures aren't too difficult to find.
There's a gigantic economic catastrophe threatening the lives of ordinary people. There's a gigantic climate catastrophe threatening the whole planet. There is every reason why we can't trust a government of the rich, for the rich, to deal with these problems.
Another reason that's brought these demonstrators here, the controversial policing bill, that gives UK police sweeping powers.
They don't need more powers. They need to be engaging with people in a protective way, not in a way where it's oppressive.
As a result of what critics call conservative government inaction, the UK has experienced one of the highest COVID death tolls in the world, massive economic downturn, a humiliating retreat from Afghanistan, hiking taxes, fuel disruptions, and a rise in Islamophobia and xenophobia in recent years.
I want to make it really clear to the Tories that they're not welcome in this city, that actually their position on fueling racism, targeting refugees, is absolutely disgusting, and therefore we want to make sure that they know just how angry we are.
A decade of conservative rule in the UK has led to a groundswell of public dissatisfaction, which experts say will manifest itself in the 2024 general election. Saeed Puriza, Manchester.
A UK police officer has been charged with rape only days after another officer was convicted of a similar assault as well as murder. London Metropolitan Police said David Carrick was arrested Saturday and suspended the same day. The arrest comes as the government and the police are trying to deal with the fallout from the conviction of another officer last week. 48-year-old Wayne Cousins was jailed Thursday for the rest of his life after falsely arresting a woman on the pretense she had broken coronavirus restrictions, then raping and killing her. Social media had been flooded with posts from women relating their own experiences of harassment and assault and calling for stricter political action to protect women. Thousands have gathered in the British capital to mark Arba'een and pay homage to Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet of Islam. Millions across the globe commemorate his martyrdom each year and remember his message. A correspondent, Bianca Rahimi, was at the event and filed this report.
Tears were shed and prayers held in London's Marble Arch, bringing the sights and sounds of Karbala to thousands that gathered there from all over the UK. People from different backgrounds, but all with one thing in common, their love for the Prophet's grandson, who was martyred on the sands of Karbala in the year 680.
This is an extension of the world's largest peaceful procession. And despite the COVID-19 pandemic, millions of people have taken part this year to commemorate Imam Hussein and his family's sacrifice and evoke their message.
Imam Hussein and his family symbolize so many things for those that hold him in their hearts, hope for the oppressed being one of them.
This is the message of Karbala. He did it so that oppression and oppressors could be brought to light. And, people who are innocent, they have hope. So it's a message of hope as well, that you're not alone in this world. There are great personalities, there are people in the world who are ready to fight for you, to die for you.
What Imam Hussein's family went through after his martyrdom is also a focal point of Arba'een, and the role the women played in the struggle. Every year, this procession highlights events that took place centuries ago, reminding humanity of the ongoing battle against tyranny that we all face today. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth. and who took no helper when he offered the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing him. Terrents fall low in awe of him. Faces are humbled in fear of him. And everything mighty yields to his mightiness. So to thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may his blessings be upon his messenger endlessly, and his salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makes the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
In the limelight. Sharp cuts in methane from leaking gas drilling platforms and production sites could play a major role in the greenhouse gas emissions reductions necessary to fulfill the Paris Climate Agreement, and should be key aim of the COP26 United Nations climate talks, new research has suggested. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's environment correspondent Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled, "Cutting Methane Should Be a Key COP26 Aim," research suggests. Stay with us for more. Sharp cuts in methane from leaking gas drilling platforms and production sites could play a major role in the greenhouse gas emissions reductions necessary to fulfill the Paris Climate Agreement, and should be a key aim of the COP26 United Nations climate talks, new research has suggested. Cutting global emissions of methane by 40% by 2030 is achievable, with most cuts possible at low cost or even at a profit for companies such as oil and gas producers. It would make up for much of the shortfall in emissions reduction plans from national governments, according to the Energy Transitions Commission think tank. Ahead of COP26, senior United Nations and British officials have privately conceded that the top aim of the conference, for all countries to formulate plans called Nationally Determined Contributions, or NDCs, that would add up to a global 45% cut in emissions by 2030, will not be met. However, Britain, as host of the summit, to be held in Glasgow in November, still hopes for enough progress to show that the world can still limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius, the aspiration of the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. Methane is a powerful greenhouse gas, about 80 times more potent than carbon dioxide in warming the planet. It is the biggest component of natural gas used for fuel, and leaks can be caused by poorly constructed conventional drilling operations, shale gas wells, gas pipelines, and other fossil fuel infrastructure. Methane is also flared from some oil production sites. Staunching such leaks or capturing the methane instead can be done at a low cost and can even be profitable for gas producers, especially now that the international gas price has soared. Just a few key producers, Russia, the United States, China, and Canada, could make a massive impact. Adair Turner, chairman of the Energy Transitions Commission think tank, ETC, said, "It is clear that if you add up the nationally determined contributions, they're not big enough to keep us to 1.5 degrees Celsius, above pre-industrial levels. There's a huge gap left. But there are some actions that you can imagine groups of countries taking that could close that gap." The United States and the European Union recently announced a partnership aiming at reducing methane emissions by 30% by 2030. But Adair Turner said more could be achieved, and this would help to compensate for the relatively unambitious nationally determined contributions that many countries have. "We have not focused enough on methane, but it can be a really important lever, and cutting it has an impact on global heating sooner rather than later, which matters if there are feedback loops in the climate system," he added. Adair Turner also pointed to other key actions that could take place at the COP26 conference, which he said would substantially help global efforts to tackle the climate crisis. For instance, helping developing countries to phase out their existing coal-fired power stations was one key way of reducing reliance on coal. In India, for instance, new coal-fired power stations are now more expensive than renewable alternatives, yet the marginal cost of electricity generation from existing coal-fired power stations is still cheaper than wind power or solar power. That means companies have an incentive to keep old coal-fired power plants going, but if they could be paid to phase out the oldest, that would accelerate the country's move away from coal. "Developing countries need financial support to do this," Adair Turner added. Steel could be another focus, according to Turner. Steel companies could move to green steel production using hydrogen far more easily than a few years ago, he said. A global agreement among steel producers at COP26 in Glasgow could achieve that, and similar global agreements were possible among cement producers, the shipping industry, and other high-carbon sectors. Many countries, Adair Turner added, were submitting their nationally determined contributions that were too cautious and did not reflect how fast businesses were already cutting emissions and moving to green energy and clean technology. Nationally determined contributions have not caught up with what is possible and what is actually happening, he said. Emissions of the powerful greenhouse gas methane have surged in the past 15 years, threatening to thwart global attempts to combat climate change. Scientists have been surprised by the surge in methane emissions, which began in 2007 and then was boosted even further in 2014 and 2015. Concentrations of methane in the atmosphere over those 2 years alone rose by more than 20 parts per billion, bringing the total to 1,830 parts per billion. This is a cause for alarm among global warming scientists because emissions of the gas warm the planet by more than 20 times as much as similar volumes of carbon dioxide.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address the most important issues in the South Asian region, what's going on, who are the key factors involved, what are the people saying, and how are issues changing the future. All of this will be answered with the help of our team of experts and guests, so stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to take a look at the revival of Quad and signing of AUKUS military pact. And we will discuss how and why the Assam government in India evicted over 800 Muslim families from a village.
It's September 24, 2021. The Quad Leaders Summit is underway at the White House. Who are in attendance? Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, US President Joe Biden, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison, and Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga. Later, Prime Minister Modi's office tweets a photograph of the four Quad leaders captioned, "The Quad, a force for global good." But what is the reality behind the story? What does the Quad or Quadrilateral Security Dialogue seek to achieve? The White House statement started off by declaring that it seeks a free and open Indo-Pacific. Many say that the U.S. hegemony is the goal and China is the target.
The Quad, or Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, is a strategic dialogue summit which has been hosting meetings between the U.S., India, Japan and Australia since 2007. For years, the summit was kept under the wraps, but it was not long until the former U.S. President Donald Trump revived the summit in 2017. Since then, U.S. President Biden seems to carry on Trump's legacy. The recent Quad meeting held on September 24, 2021, certainly raised many eyebrows. Although the post-meeting statement released by the White House talked much about response to COVID-19 and infrastructure development, critics remain skeptical, as the statement's punchline was to promote an Indo-Pacific region that is quote-unquote undaunted by coercion. Analysts say China is the obvious target. Foreign Ministry spokesman Zhao Lijian already accused the Quad group of being dedicated to undermining China's interests. After the Quad's virtual summit in March 2021, the Defense Ministry said, The group hangs on to Cold War mentality, pursues group confrontation, is keen on geopolitical games, and openly incites discord between regional countries. Earlier Quad meetings have come parallel with provocative and hawkish military and naval exercises in the Indo-Pacific region, such as the Malabar naval exercises, which some commentators claim had the potential to start a new Cold War between the US and China. This time, some say that the Western hegemonic powers have taken it too far, as the recent Quad summit comes right after the AUKUS Trilateral Security Pact was announced between Australia, the United Kingdom, and the United States, which aims to help Australia acquire nuclear-powered submarines.
If the Quad wasn't enough, the U.S. has doubled down on its efforts to interfere in a region which is between 12 to 15,000 kilometers away from its land. The U.S. has come into a security partnership with the U.K. and Australia for, quote, peace and stability in the Indo-Pacific region. It seems that the U.S. has become so paranoid of China's rise to power that the U.S. and the U.K. not only snubbed their NATO and EU allies, but also led to the scrapping of France's $38.6 billion contract with Australia to build 12 diesel submarines, which has made the European Union feel uneasy.
The U.S. is forming a new Indo-Pacific security alliance with Britain and Australia, whereby the countries will collaborate on military and cyber capabilities, artificial intelligence, quantum technologies, and undersea capabilities, while Australia will also acquire new long-range strike capabilities for its Air Force and Navy and nuclear capabilities for its submarines. The Telegraph, a leading UK news publisher, reported that in March 2021, the Australian Navy Chief met in London with his British counterpart and requested assistance from the UK and the US in acquiring nuclear-powered submarines. Finally, without Macron's knowledge, a trilateral discussion was held between Johnson, Biden, and Morrison at the June 2021 G7 summit in England to finalise the deal. Consequently, Australia decided to cancel the $38.6 billion contract with France, for which it had already spent about $2.4 billion. The move has led to a diplomatic crisis between the US, UK, and France, with the French Foreign Minister calling the move a stab in the back. German Europe Minister Michael Roth even said France's diplomatic crisis with the US was a wake-up call for all of us on the importance of uniting an often divided EU on foreign and security policy. Nevertheless, the agreement to transfer US or UK nuclear submarine technology, including possibly highly enriched uranium, has been described as an act of nuclear proliferation, which is considered illegal according to the international law.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Pepe Escobar, an author and geopolitical analyst. Ms. Escobar, welcome to the program, sir. Now, let's begin by asking about your thoughts on the significance of the AUKUS military pact and why is the U.S. so interested in maintaining influence over the Indo-Pacific region?
Well, first of all, it's not Indo-Pacific. Nobody in Asia, here in Asia, uses the term Indo-Pacific. This is empire speak. The correct denomination is Asia Pacific, and it's been for decades. In fact, this is anyone in from Southeast Asia, where I am, to Central Asia, to East Asia. Everybody refers to Asia Pacific. So this new terminology is an imperial invention, basically to make sure that the Quad has some sort of legitimacy. So Indo-Pacific was invented to bring India into what it is already, Cold War 2.0 against China conducted by the Empire. And in terms of the Quad, there are allies, Australia, India, and Japan. AUKUS new scheme or racket or pact or sort of agreement. Basically, is the Americans telling the Australians, we're going to use you as our springboard, as our forward base in the East, in the Pacific, against China. But this is a very, very long-term project. In fact, there's only one very, very good analysis so far, not by accident by the Russians, on what does that mean in the long run for Asia-Pacific. Basically, the Americans are planning some sort of nuclear conflagration against China for the second half of the 2030s. So this means these are 8 nuclear-propelled submarines that are going to be built.
Now in his address to the UN General Assembly, Joe Biden sought to reassure the world that Washington is not seeking a Cold War with China. However, with the recent Quad Summit meeting and the AUKUS bombshell in play, what message do you think this sends to China?
Well, the Quad basically is, for the moment, the Quad is a talk shop. They're going to have one meeting a year, which is not much. But of course, the intel agencies will be in close contact. It's driven by the U.S. It's an exclusive American operation. The other ones are mere vassals, of course. And the importance of Australia, it's because it's part of the Anglo Club, of course. Britain is not part of the Quad. India is part of the Quad, but India and Japan are treated as minor players, even though they haven't noticed that yet. So this is an Anglo Club operation. Australia is being instrumentalized by this American obsession. So basically, it's the Anglo Club, but controlled, once again, controlled by the U.S., but Australia now launched into a very, very dangerous position. And obviously, the Chinese will have plenty of time to not only understand the consequences, but to prepare about what might happen in the second half of the 2030s.
Mr. Escobar, thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how the people have reacted on social media and cyberspace on the Quad Summit and the signing of the AUKUS military pact.
Carlos Martinez, an anti-war activist, says the world eagerly awaits an end to military escalation against China, dismantling of AUKUS, NATO and the Quad, and end of illegal sanctions against countries like Iran. Lawyer and writer Akshay Chudasama says formation of the AUKUS and the Quad makes it clear that USA wants to curb China's growing involvement in global affairs. Kerry Collison, an international author, shares an Asia Times article that says the new big power security architecture exacerbates the divisions within ASEAN regarding the US-China struggle for dominance. Author and academic Happyman Jacob says if AUKUS overshadows the enthusiasm around the Quad, it would be disadvantageous to India's interests in the Indo-Pacific.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
On Monday, September 20th, 2021, 800 Muslim families, which consisted of around 5,000 individuals, including women, children, and the elderly, were kicked out of their homes in the Darang district of the Assam province in India. four Muslim religious sites were demolished and two people were killed, while several others, including police officers, were injured. Different groups have cited different reasons for the evictions. BJP government leaders claim that these people were illegal Bengali immigrants who were encroaching on government land. Many local news channels and BBC Bangla claim that the eviction drives were also being conducted to restore a prehistoric Hindu temple, while some human rights and minority groups have termed it communal politics driven by prejudice against Muslims.
A mass eviction campaign is underway in the Indian province of Assam. According to Assam Chief Minister Himanta Biswa Sarma, 800 families have been evicted and four religious structures have also been destroyed as a part of a drive against illegal encroachments. According to the Indian non-profit news website The Wire, the actual figure could be 900 and number of affected could be up to 20,000 people. The figures worry some people more than others because most of the affectees are Muslims. The BJP government leaders claim that the people being evicted are illegal immigrants from Bangladesh, but there is confusion as to how these affectees have been deemed so, seeing that origins of many rural settlements and settlers are unclear. The answer? A highly controversial citizens list, the National Register of Citizens. The NRC made almost 2 million residents of Assam province stateless and led to massive waves of deadly protests in India because it was seen as prejudiced against Muslims. Accordingly, protests have now erupted after reports of violence have emerged since the eviction drive started. Indian Congress Party leader Rahul Gandhi claimed that Assam is on state-sponsored fire after two people were killed and at least 20 people were injured by open firing and live use of ammunition by the police. Social media witnessed shocking videos of police using violence and open firing against people protesting the forced evictions. There was even a video showing a man kicking an apparently dead person with a bullet wound on his chest and jumping over his body.
Not too long ago, in 2019, the government in India was considering legalizing illegal settlements in Delhi, which would include some 700,000 households in unauthorized settlements in the city. Now, the question is, why are these people in Assam being treated differently? Even if we agree to claim that the evicted people in Assam are illegal settlers, and even if we forget about giving proper rights to these people, there is another question to ponder over. Where will these people live? How will they get the basic necessities to live and survive? And most importantly, do these people really deserve this?
Despite having evicted 800 families and having cleared 602.40 hectares, the Assam chief minister claims that the eviction drives will not stop. The government has provided no rehabilitation plan to deal with the suffrage of the evicted people who live without water, shelter, or food. Assam Pradesh Congress President Bhupen Kumar has raised concerns about the coronavirus pandemic and the vulnerability these people have been placed in. India is one of the world's worst affected countries when it comes to the COVID-19. And around 500,000 people have so far died in the country. Kumar also claimed that the Supreme Court had also given a directive against eviction during the pandemic situation, yet the state government, led by Sarma, has been behaving in an autocratic manner to evict the residents of Dholpur, who have been living in the area since the 1970s. Hate and violence against the Bengali Muslims of Assam are not new. Harrowing screams of women and children being massacred during the Nelli massacre of 1983 can still be heard. 38 years ago in the same province, over 2,000 people were massacred during a span of 6 hours. What is the cause of division till this day? Some say divisive politics. Former BJP President Amit Shah
referred to illegal Bengali immigrants as termites, and the rhetoric has been similar across the party leadership. The current Assam chief minister earlier fought and won the BJP's second stint in power in Assam by framing it as a contest between 65% Hindus and 35% Muslims.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Shoaib Daniel, a journalist based in New Delhi. Now, welcome to the program, Mr. Daniel. Sir, almost 5,000 people, including children and elderly persons, have been forced to live under the open sky in Assam's Darang district. Could you elaborate more on the dire situation in Darang?
So this is basically an issue in the northeastern state of Assam in India. And this is an extremely old issue in which Bengali Muslims, which are Muslims of who speak the language Bengali, are often victimized in the state of Assam. They are often branded as Bangladeshi immigrants, which is the country to the east of India. Although very often these accusations are incorrect and driven more by xenophobia than any fact. So this is another continuation of that, where now Muslims, Bengali Muslims, who are being evicted from land that the government claims is not theirs. So this is yet another iteration. We've had many iterations of this conflict coming into fore recently. A couple of years back, we had something called the National Register of Citizens, which was very unique in the world, where every citizen of Assam, as long as they were, you know, they weren't quote unquote indigenous, was checked for their citizenship. So this is the way, it's a sort of a mix between communal politics, which looks at the division between Hindus and Muslims, but also there is an ethnic mix.
Mr. Daniel, from what I know, two people have died and several others have been injured so far. Now, why is the BJP-led government going to the extent of using violence against these people, and what is there to achieve?
So so we'll have to just quickly go into the recent politics to understand that there's a new chief minister in Assam. His name is Himanta Biswa Sarma. And he's really stepped up this process for what he calls evictions. So in this case, he's using extreme violence as well as very publicized violence, you know, in a very sort of jingoist and very aggressive manner to try and evict what he calls squatters on land. So, I mean, there is actually no need to use this violence, but yet this provides, it's a beneficial politics for this chief minister as well as the party that he belongs to, which is the ruling BJP, which is Mr. Modi's party. So I think that's why he's doing it, because it provides, there is a strong, unfortunately, there is a strong, there is a strong market in Assam politics for this sort of aggression against Bengali Muslims. So hence he's doing that.
Mr. Daniel, two Muslim mosques and one religious school were also demolished. Now, could you say this encroachment drive is part of a larger campaign to disenfranchise Muslims?
I would actually, while there is of course growing, you know, there's growing Islamophobia in India, and there are growing, as you know, many people have pointed out, there is a shrinking democratic space in India, with Muslims being at the receiving end in many cases. This incident is actually, I mean, while there is an India repercussion, in which case that it's the BJP that is in Assam, and a lot of their politics feeds into Assam, but this is also a very local and old conflict, where Bengali Muslims who are an ethnic minority in the state of Assam, although they're a minority which is very large, they're one third of Assam, but still they are very poor, so they're getting attacked. So while there is, I would answer that question in yes and no. While there is an all India, while there's an all India umbrella under which this is happening, the virulence of this and the scale of violence that was used is very much a product of this state's politics, and might not necessarily, at least in the near term, map to other parts of India, at least in its scale.
Mr. Daniel, thank you for being on the program. Now, let's see how the people have reacted on social media and cyberspace on the recent mass evictions of Muslim families in Assam's Darang district.
Independent journalist Sakshi Yoshi says most TV channels in India didn't give space to Moinul because the incident took place in BJP-ruled Assam state and the victim was a Muslim. Gaurav Gogoi, a Congress parliamentarian, slams India Today Media Group for irresponsible reporting on people being evicted in Assam. He says it is neither factual and nor based on draft NRC list. Politician and activist Abdul Majid terms the eviction of Muslims and police firing in Assam as outrageous and says the police act was highly outrageous, inhumane and brutal. Mahmoudul Hassan, a multimedia journalist, quotes victim's brother as saying that the police killed his brother after a brutal assault while demanding justice for his slain brother. Prominent journalist and TV anchor Gargi Rawat shares an article that debunks the false theory that those killed in police firing in Assam were illegal Rohingyas.
And that was our episode on India, Quad and AUKUS military pact and the mass evictions of Muslim families in India. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Some verdures. Very sour. This stew shouldn't be that sour. What can I do now? I'd better not to add the dried lime to the stew. Oh, what a mixture would it turn out to be? Well, today I have two guests, and I'm cooking for them. This is gourmet sabzi, one of the most delicious and popular meals in Iran. And in the evening, I'm going to take my guests to one of the delicious streets of Tehran, to Sietiri Street, the center of street foods. Sietiri Street is located at District 12. This street is one of the oldest streets of Tehran. The most important monuments of this street include the National Museum of Iran, St. Peter's Church,
Obgyne Museum, Tehran Industrial Vocational School, Iranian National Museum of Science and Technology, and Hayyim Synagogue. Since past times, Siyatir Street has been known as a tourist attraction site of Tehran. Most of the historical sites of Tehran, which have been registered by the heritage sites, are located in this street. Due to the existence of a hospital in this street, Siyatir used to be known as Marizkhane Street, literally Hospital Street. This old hospital is still standing tall, but its name has changed to Sina Hospital. I am now at the beginning of Siyatir Street. Here, so crowded. Siyatir Street is the center of street foods in Tehran. Just beside me, there is a stand which has a really big brass samovar. This stand sells fragrant Iranian tea with different flavors, with rose, cardamom, and cinnamon. I have bought a cup of cinnamon tea. I love this flavor.